the reality is, because of these complexities of nutrition, people that are quote-unquote evidence-based fuck up their interpretation of nutrition studies all the time. And it's not their fault. It's a difficult science. Some of this shit is hard to spot.
Welcome back to Not Nutrition Gurus. I'm your host, Rachel Hunter, where we are firmly planted in the unsexy, nuanced middle ground of the health and fitness industry. Please keep your arms, hands, and feet inside the vehicle at all times. And remember, no gurus allowed. How are you, mon petit pois, on this fine, fine day? I hope that you are doing something wonderful and spectacular. And if you're not, you're now listening to this podcast. So hopefully this is a nice little rose in the day of thorns, right? I don't know, maybe. Makes it sound like I think extremely highly of this podcast. But that brings me nicely to my next point. This podcast is with my friend-ish slash mentor, Dr. Alan Flanagan. He is a researcher in the field of nutrition. He completed his PhD in chrononutrition, which, to be honest with you, like, there's a lot of things that my brain copes with really, really well with understanding. Chrononutrition, not really one of those things. But luckily, we don't really touch on that very much today. I am a part of Alenia, which is Alan's educational hub. And I think what I find so impressive about Alan is that he is able to take quite a comprehensive view of nutrition research as a whole and then treat it like a 3D chessboard. Like, it's not just that he's well-read, it's that he is exceptionally good at, you know, applying it to everyday life, real people, and sort of making it make sense. So I hope that you really, really enjoy this episode. Alan and I are both incredibly verbose, so this episode is actually in two parts. The second part I will be releasing next week. This episode can be summed up as, is nutrition research fucked? And why is it that it is just open season on zealots and charlatans making assumptions for themselves and what that actually means in the field of nutrition and for people like me who work with clients? It's a really excellent episode. Neither of us had a very busy schedule the day we recorded, so that's why this episode was so long and I split it into two because we covered a lot. But we chatted some shit, we had a good time, and Alan said a lot of really interesting things. So on to the episode. Welcome, Alan, to the Not Nutrition Gurus podcast. I like that the other day you put in your Instagram about not listening to gurus, and we're recording. Mm-hmm. I knew we were recording this today, so I'm quite pleased that it's all come together quite nicely.
It's yeah, and I get to be a guru, I guess.
You get to be a pretend guru, or not a guru, which is better.
Yeah, we're not a guru. Yeah.
So today on the podcast, we have Dr. Alan Flanagan. How are you today, Alan?
I'm, you know, fine. I'm doing just fine, which in anyone else's terms would be probably very good. Yeah.
Ecstatic.
Even keel. Whatever that feels like.
So upbeat for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm here, you know, so.
So you're recording a podcast.
My tempo has increased somewhat, slightly.
Oh, fantastic. All around a good day then. Okay, so I have officially now bullied Alan into coming onto the podcast to talk about all things nutrition research related. But first, Alan, would you mind telling us, this will be an interesting question, tell us about yourself, but that has nothing to do with what you do for work.
That has nothing to do with what I do for work.
So PhD.
Well, this is the thing, because when I think about my kind of day-to-day life and my interests, I still don't really think of myself in terms of the nutrition research and science side of things. Like, I'm a humanities kid at heart. Like, my undergrad degree was English and history. And then I went to law school, and then I was in that for the guts of a decade. And it's like, my day to day, obviously I'm interested in this stuff deeply, but my day to day, like the things that kind of interest me and make me tick, the subjects that I'm like looking to buy a book on and read, still all relate to my kind of formative interests. So it's funny then, because I get asked all the time, people are like, oh, like, what's a good nutrition book to read? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. Why would I read a book about nutrition? I couldn't really think of. Yeah, fair enough. There are one or two I've read that, like,
there's a couple
have written that, you know, that I would recommend to people. But yeah, I just I'm interested in this stuff for various reasons, but because I spend so much of my time, you know, reading a study or reading around a study for like the deep dives, or like prepping for a podcast with Danny, like the background reading to that research question or whatever it is we're delving into, it's like I don't want to think about this stuff outside of that. Like, yeah, so that's the rest of my, and so yeah, even here, I guess here for people that probably aren't here for me is London. It's like, yeah, most of what occupies my time here is still all related to those initial interests.
History, English, yeah. Lit type.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Museums, exhibitions, theaters, like.
To be fair, that's the good stuff. That's the
stuff that actually gives me, like, yeah, I think so. Like, science is interesting, and it's the method that humans need to actually be able to get some sort of grasp on approximate truths and be able to explain the world we find ourselves in. But there's just serious limits to what science can actually give us at a kind of deeper level, and certainly at a cultural level. Like, science isn't, culture isn't formed from science, from scientific knowledge. It helps kind of advance society and technological advances and otherwise, but it doesn't give you culture the way the arts and literature and the humanities does. So the analogy that I typically use is that, like, science gives you the tools to be able to, like, build a house and make sure it's on solid foundations and know what materials are going to make the walls last for years, but it can't tell you how to decorate it or what color to paint it or what interior to put into it or anything like that. And I think I get a richer experience from those types of questions than I do from science in some ways.
Yeah. I love that. That is a great analogy, though. And I think there's something you just said made me think of, I think he's a British comedian. Couldn't tell you what his name was right now. And one of his lines from one of his sets is, people get so upset when they say, well, science doesn't know everything. And he was like, yes, that is the point. Otherwise, no, science would just stop.
Wouldn't fucking exist. Yeah. Yeah. It's Dara O'Brien. What's the national equivalent of misgendering? Because this happens all the time.
Oh, is he Irish?
With Irish.
Oh,
yeah,
gosh.
Of course he's Irish. Listen to his voice.
Yeah, but I couldn't. You know who I'm getting him confused with? Who is English is the guy who used to be a teacher. Is his name Greg something?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, but that's.
But they're just like tall, kind of.
Dara O'Brien has that gas skit of being like, well, science doesn't know everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, of course it fucking doesn't, or it wouldn't exist. Like, yeah,
exactly. He's like, or it would just stop. And I was like, that's the best. Oh my God. Yeah. And the fact that this has been recorded, and not only are my Irish friends never going to let me live that down, my Irish clients are probably going to fire me after that. So
that's
can't
it.
Wait. Yeah. Can't wait for that. That's me done.
The cardinal sin.
The cardinal sin.
Well, it's happened over the year. It's really funny because it happens a lot with, like, you know, like athletes or otherwise, and they'll be called, you know, British.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah, not really.
Oh yeah, I love that when I think Andy Murray often will get hit, like if he's on the up, England claims him, or the United Kingdom claims him, and then when he's not, he's Scottish.
He's just Scottish, yeah.
And I think, you know, well, I hold an American and a Canadian passport, so I'm not easily offended when people say one or the other, so, but I have some Canadian friends who are like, I am absolutely not American. I'm like, all right, relax. You're fine.
Yeah.
You will be okay.
Yeah, Canadians do get animated by that.
Oh, God, yeah. Which, like, I can understand. But unfortunately, I'm stuck with the accent for forever. And I have a passport for the time being. Yeah. So we'll see.
You're safe here. Safer here.
100%.
Yeah. Your womb is yours.
God. Yep. And for that, we are thankful. So on that upbeat note, what do you do for a living, for work? What is your bread and butter?
So my is a combination of Alinea Nutrition, which is my education hub online, which is a research review for nutrition research. And then I also work with none other than Mr. Danny Lennon for Sigma Nutrition. And then I am going to stay in academic research. My PhD is done and dusted. And now I'm kind of enjoying just having more time really to kind of focus on Alinea and Sigma. And me and Danny have a nice project we've been working on that's starting to come together, which is a kind of how to read nutrition research course. So it's nice having this extra time to be able to focus on the project that I didn't have the time to focus on while I was finishing my PhD. But I'm also now starting to kind of look ahead to thinking about postdoc research, which will also be part of what I do for a living. But that's definitely more on the kind of sense of purpose and value side. Like I want to be in research, not necessarily for financial reasons as much as I just want to be. I want to be involved in research kind of directly myself. I still want to be doing and contributing to nutrition science, not just necessarily critiquing it and kind of communicating it for other healthcare professionals, which I really, really do enjoy. I get enormous value from that. And the community aspect that comes with our respective audiences for Alinea and Sigma, and they largely overlap. It's the same kind of avatar of an individual in terms of their level of interest in the subject, in terms of the kind of baseline kind of level of kind of, you know, a degree of scientific literacy and critical literacy that people would have, that I think would be our common avatar of an audience person. And so I enjoy that side of it immensely, but I do at this point anyway, in kind of my new life in nutrition, definitely want to stay involved in research at least for a few more years. And then I'll kind of reassess then.
Oh, brilliant. And I mean, I have to say, you are very good at your ability to sort of like unravel and then sort of reposition nutrition research in such a way as sort of like, yeah, I can see why this, that, and the other thing would be cherry picked and run away with by the actual charlatans. And the actual gurus, but also why, you know, as a coach working with people who I genuinely want them to be better off, I wouldn't necessarily make that same recommendation, and like, but at least now I can like understand why and explain it, which
Anyone who I think says sits around and is like, yeah, I do all of my own research and I understand everything perfectly by myself. And I'm like, I barely even have the literacy to understand like stats. And I've taken stats at a university level. Like, I'm not an idiot, but like, it's not, this isn't training wheels. Like, you just pick it up and you're like, yep, understood. Here we go.
And this is a big problem with the wider kind of conversation, particularly the one we see online. Like, I had a post the other day because I have a fairly common conversation that occurs for me on social media frequently enough is often lay people who are really interested in their health, right? They consume health information all over the place. They're probably the people who least need to worry about this stuff, but they're fucking obsessed with it. And I am kind of baffled by this level of interest in many respects. Because I'm like, well, you know, if you're just wondering what you need to kind of relatively do to eat to be healthy, and what kind of exercise you need to do to generally be healthy, and whether you should sleep consistently to be healthy, you don't need Andrew Huberman's fucking podcast. You don't need like, follow the dietary guidelines, be active, and fucking go to sleep at night. Like, this isn't complicated. So I'm kind of baffled in many respects by this phenomenon of lay people not just being interested in this stuff, but expecting to be able to understand the actual scientific research, which is like me expecting to be able to understand a subject I've never touched on before, right? Mm. Like I had no interest in kind of maths or physics when I was in school. Like, this is like me deciding now I'm really interested in physics. This is cool. And then getting frustrated online when someone tells me, listen, you should probably just not necessarily worry about trying to figure all this out. And so, you know, this kind of post I did the other day, basically saying, look, like, don't be so gullible, ask some basic questions. And the amount of comments that people left being like, but, you know, how am I supposed to know then if PhD X is more credible than PhD Y? And how am I supposed to understand all of the areas of research that impact on my life? And I'm like, I think you're taking this too far. Like, and it's what comes through in that dialogue is people are like genuinely expecting to be able, that there's some level at which this can be communicated at that is accessible to absolutely anyone. And this isn't to sound any sort of academic ivory tower. It's just the reality that you can't. This is like someone who's never read history before coming along and being like, cool, I'm really interested in learning about the Second World War. It's like, right, well, here's a book you can read. And they read it and it's a general history. And then they're now worried, you know, they're now freaking out because they're saying, well, how would I ever be able to grasp the complexities of cracking the enigma or something, you know? And it's just because you're not in this discipline spending every day of your life reading this shit and upskilling on the various domains of knowledge that you need to be able to properly understand it, like statistics. So I think that part of it is really unreasonable expectations that people have for what they expect to be able to know. And that's why it's important that we have people that are able to do that legwork for them. But like, there's going to be a point where a layperson is simply not going to be able to understand a multivariate regression model. And most nutrition practitioners, people who work with people, probably don't fucking either. So it's a weird, I don't know. We're in this weird place with the role of this applies generally. The role of science in the public sphere is in a very bizarre place right now. And I don't really know what I think of it.
I think that you touched on a number of interesting things, because I think I know exactly who you're talking about. So quite a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are quote unquote who you might deem as like a layperson or general population. It's essentially sort of like trying to understand enough so that they can like go about their day and understand that they're making good choices and kind of not get so bogged down in the surrounding nonsense. But I know exactly who you're talking about, where it's sort of like taking that kind of crunchy granola feeling and then chasing it down until said goal gives up from exhaustion. It's not just understanding it. It is hunting the answer down. And almost, you know, I think that's a special variation of sort of shiny object syndrome. Where it's sort of like, now is the thing that I'm going to sort of like fixate on. And some people go from thing to thing to thing to thing. Shiny object. Next shiny object, next shiny object. So, you know, obviously big one now is like cold plunge and saunas. And like in 2010, it was like, if you weren't doing CrossFit and paleo, like you were going to die alone with 100 cats. And, you know, it changes all the time. Whereas because the reality as a human is that it's pretty like what you actually need to do to look after yourself is pretty fucking boring.
And it's basic.
And it's not necessarily easy for everyone because, you know, in the podcast that came out a week before this one with Ella Whitcomb Khan and sort of going through things about self-sabotage and beliefs that we have. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's simple or easy to do. But then also, and another thing that you touched on, which I, you know, sort of specifically, I suppose, wanted to speak to you about today, where sort of like nutrition research does seem to hold this special attention for everyone. Like it is truly held in contempt in the same, like in a very different way than like, let's say physics, you know, where it's sort of like someone might go to like a lecture by Brian Cox and sort of leave and be like, wow, I didn't really know that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they're never going to, you're never going to think about it again. It's never going
to
come up.
Yeah. Yeah. Nor would they expect to be able to like challenge him and like argue back and forth like as if they were a peer.
Yeah, exactly. Brian Cox, I can show you a thing or two.
Brian, I'm sorry, I don't think you're actually quite right there, you know.
Yeah. And even just telling meeting new people and telling people my job, I would rather lie and say I'm an accountant until I know what kind of response I'm going to get, because I'm tired of defending fruit.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm tired of going to bat for like blueberries.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous, but I feel like nutrition research is sort of, it's treated because everybody eats food. And we do live in an extremely, you know, the term obesogenic, I feel like doesn't necessarily lend itself to being understood, but essentially an obesogenic environment in, you know, and if you live in any sort of Western culture, you know, the second you leave your house, McDonald's, Burger King, the ads you hear on the radio, the types of foods that you're eating, where it is the perfect combination of sugar, salt, and fat, making you want to eat lots of it, but it's not necessarily dense in nutrients. You know, you don't leave your house and like blueberries and strawberries and like broccoli are like, the broccoli farmers are out there like, hey, come down to my broccoli restaurant and eat loads. It's like, here are all these really, really highly processed foods, which are really, really easy to overeat. So because we live in this environment that is unhinged from a food perspective, and then everyone eats, and then we have this sort of like self, as Ella called it from my podcast last week, this self-front responsibility porn, plus all these people who get really exceptionally well-known podcasts and then just cherry pick charlatans to go on said podcast and just perpetuate their own biases. Nutrition research is just like fucked in a different way that many other levels of research just are left to it to some respect.
Yeah. So I don't think there's another field of research. I don't think there's another academic discipline I can think of, irrespective of whether it's in the sciences or the humanities, that has the same level of sense of entitlement to speak to that field as nutrition. And the idea that nutrition science is just there as something to be claimed and spoken for, whether that's by a GP who hasn't read a paper since med school in any sort of critical way and swallows whatever fad diet stuff they end up following, usually low carb or kind of hardcore plant-based. Whether that's a consultant who thinks that because they're a medical consultant, they are God himself and or herself. And, you know, and that bestows on them omnipotent knowledge to be able to speak with authority on any area, or whether that's people from other academic fields that are, quote, interested in nutrition, and I kind of use that term pejoratively, to whether that's just your average bro who's, quote, done his research. It's unparalleled that there is any other academic discipline that has this level of sense of entitlement over an assumption that the research is just there to be read and understood in the most superficial way. And this is why I think we have so much nonsense about nutrition overall. And people on the healthcare side love to blame the wellness influencers, this avatar. They're the problem with misinformation. It's some girl with 500,000 followers doing glute kickbacks with a band and telling people to eat a certain way, or it's some bro, gym bro, with his abs out and his 500,000 followers telling people that, you know, he's shredded because of he just eats meat. That's an easy out for, I think, a lot of people that are in healthcare kind of areas, and I use that term very broadly, inclusive of like PTs, for example. I would include them in the umbrella of healthcare professionals. It's very easy then to blame this kind of avatar of a kind of wellness influencer pushing, you know, some juice kind of diet, when in reality, in my opinion, the vast majority of the fuckery comes from conversations with people and between people who have some sort of fucking set of letters after their name. But the, you know, whether that's like Paul Saladino, who's technically a medical doctor, but I think he's a psychiatrist with his training. Sean Baker was a doctor. I think he got struck off when he came up with the carnivore. Well, I don't know what he got struck off for. Asim Alhatra, consultant cardiologist. Eric Berg. Like, these are all doctors, MDs, PhDs, mostly not in nutrition at all. And then, of course, then you've got other people from other healthcare modalities, whether it's kind of psychology, psychiatry, whatever, personal trainers, strength and conditioning coaches. So these are all people nominally with some sort of title as a healthcare professional, and blame it on wellness influencers all they like, but they're not really the problem. The problem is people that have some sort of healthcare credential attached to their name. They're the real reason that we have so much bullshit and noise.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with that. I think that it, because then often, like, the wellness influencer, like, they can kind of piggyback off of something else, someone else. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like they're not at the top of the pyramid. The trickle down effect of the misinformation doesn't start with them. Although the one that I do see quite often at the minute that just fucks me off is the hormone balancing.
These
white women. It's the white women. Instagram. What the fuck are we doing out there, ladies? Enough.
I don't know. It's interesting. And I've even seen credible people start to kind of use that rhetoric as well. I'm like, no, be really careful here. It's so, I think as well, just there's something about nutrition. If we look at even the demographics of the field, it's probably the only profession in the world that isn't dominated by men, or at least historically, like a lot of the professions have balanced out more in the last 10 to 15 years. But nutrition is almost exclusively a wealthy white female profession in terms of dietetics and nutrition. And that even in many respects extends into academic nutrition as well. And I think then when you push that out then into the wider kind of social media world, and you also factor in various other kind of healthcare modalities for which nutrition is some sort of adjuvant or kind of part of what people are doing with their coaching. And I think this broad term now, coaching, it's like, I don't know what that means anymore, really. Because I don't know with the way that term is used on social media, is that a marketing guru now who's teaching coaches to coach coaches, or how does this work? I don't know. But this term, knowing that nutrition is a very female dominated space, generally, women are also underrepresented in medical research. There are multiple female specific conditions for which there's a really poor evidence base. So women, I think, are often the ones left looking for answers that medicine isn't in a position to give them right now. And that leads them to goop culture, and it leads them to hormone balancing, and it leads them to fad shit diets, and it leads them to all sorts of nutrition related bollocks. And so I think that more than anything, as a target market to direct bullshit towards, I think women are disproportionately a kind of target of wellness culture generally, but of which nutrition obviously is an enormous part of it. And again, because nutrition on the kind of practice side even and everything is also a kind of more women dominated space, it means that what you have is this culture where it's women perpetuating this for women or at women. And that's tricky, you know. I think that's a kind of tricky thing, because it comes under this guise of like women supporting women and empowerment and all that bullshit rhetoric, but like it's really not. I think it's the opposite of empowerment. I think if you're selling people down the Swanee on health practices they don't need because they're desperate and looking for answers because they've PCOS or endometriosis or whatever it is, and they're not really getting good answers. So it's natural that they're looking elsewhere and they're turning to this idea that it's other women that have figured it out for them. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that exists within the nutrition space.
I think also maybe because it immediately enrages me, I notice it more. Probably. But any man who labels himself a female fat loss coach, women's fat loss coach, there is something in me that just wants to push him into moving traffic. And I would like to let the record show that I've never done that, nor will I, but I think about it every single time.
I would commit to that.
It is the most ludicrous thing that I've, and I bet you there are a very, very small percentage of men who like truly have taken the time to not just read the research and talk about the menstrual cycle in the different weeks and know what a luteal phase is. And they actually have spoken to women, and not just as their coaches and not just because they are paying them, but have very deep and meaningful connections with women in their everyday life. And they truly aim to understand, maybe. Those type of men, though, almost never do I ever see saying they are women's fat loss coaches. They are just good at their job, and they have figured out ways to market themselves that are not seemingly predatory.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know men who are exceptionally good at what they do, and, being a female and speaking to them, feeling valued and respected outside of, paying them or any sort of like relationship that it might seem as they like seemingly benefit, quote unquote, from, which is great. It's just basic human respect. Those men often do not label themselves as such, but there is a predatory vibe very much, especially on Instagram, to women around bouncing hormones and PCOS and, oh, well, you have belly fat because your cortisol is too high and you have menopause. One of my clients, she listens to the podcast, shout out, you know who you are. She very nicely once sent me the quote unquote meal plan that she was given from a doctor who was selling menopausal something or other for nutrition. And she was like, oh, Rach, I have like the whole Google Drive. Do you just want to see it? I was like, absolutely, I do. Send it over. And it's just eating minimally processed foods. Mostly it's eating, right. You know, basically it's dietary guidelines with lean proteins and oily fish and lots of veggies and complex carbohydrates. I was like, how much money was this? She was like, I don't want to talk about it. I was like, okay, that's fair enough.
And this is for all the complexities of nutrition as a science, and it's interesting, and for the complexities of human metabolism and a lot of the relationships between diet and the conditions that we have. Sometimes in my more nihilistic moments, which is usually 16 out of 24 hours, I wonder what utility there is to nutrition research as a whole. I'm like, what do we need to know? Like, what do we need to know? That the fucking Mediterranean diet's good for you? That you should have minimally processed foods with plenty of servings of fruit and vegetables and have more unsaturated fats than saturated fats and eat dietary fiber and get some good whole grains in? And what the fuck else do we need to know right now? And the answer is nothing. If we're really honest, this is an uncomfortable place for me to sit, because I genuinely think a lot, even about future research that I'd like to do. And I'm like, what would I do that would be meaningful? And when push comes to shove with a lot of these recommendations, it's the same stuff. How it looks can be different.
Yeah.
Like, I was looking at what's known as the Baltic Sea diet, right? It's a recommendation, the dietary recommendations and the Nordic nutrition recommendations. So the Baltic Sea recommendations are the dietary recommendations you'd get in like Estonia and the Baltic countries, Denmark. And then there's also, they're also the other Nordic countries. And they're based on these like recommendations that they had that were kind of culture specific. So for example, you get specific recommendations for berry consumption that you wouldn't in the UK, which is just generic fruit intake, right? So, okay, cool. There's a difference there, but at its core, it's basically saying eat fruit. There's some specifics to it that would differ from culture to culture. They have some specific recommendations regarding like fermented dairy that you might not get elsewhere. But like, these are nuanced differences within an overall principle that is universal, which is eating fucking fruit is good. And so I genuinely wonder, it's like, what exactly is it we need to know? We don't have a knowledge deficit. So if we don't have a knowledge deficit, what's the fucking problem? And then you start to realize that's probably where nutrition specifically as a science runs up against its limitations, because the areas of science that matter most for nutrition, ironically, are then behavioral, economic, environmental, and otherwise. I genuinely wonder whether nutrition as a standalone field, it can't continue where it's currently at, because it's not adding anything of value. Like, I'm astounded when I look through particularly kind of mid-tier journals that are borderline predatory in their, not predatory in that like they deliberately seek to publish like false stuff, but predatory in the way that they're aggressive in their publishing practices. And like nutrients, for example. And I look at these this list of 100 papers that have been published in this month's edition. I'm like, 100 papers this month?
Yeah.
And it's and I'm like, what are we doing with this? And you look at what these papers are, and it's like vitamin D in the treatment of scoliosis, a narrative review. What the fuck? Like, or it's another bullshit time-restricted eating study. They've done nothing different. They've added nothing of value. Or it's these, like, I take the piss a lot out of this, like the Mediterranean diet, because I'm like, it's meaningless. It's an absolutely meaningless term. We think it means something. It's meaningless. Because all these papers now, it's like, we used a modified Mediterranean diet. And I'm like, so it was burgers and chips with some olive oil. Like, know, it's like, there's nothing modified or Mediterranean. So, and I'm genuinely wondering, unless it's really nitty gritty metabolomics, kind of some of this advanced methodology, which I even question what the practical value of that is. There's no way that nutrition research can continue to add so little value. It's almost becoming like some subjects in the humanities that end in studies, you know, something studies. Like, it's becoming that diluted and lacking of substance. And you're like, where is the high value research being done and published? And there are some examples, but I really wonder, like, if ultimately what we would say to someone going through menopause at the age of, let's say, 55, hypothetically, versus someone in their early 40s with some elevated cholesterol, but otherwise healthy, to someone in their 20s just looking to be healthy proactively, when the reality is that the recommendations would not be any different for any one of those circumstances. What are we doing? I really don't know.
Yeah. I think that...
I just had an existential crisis on your podcast.
we can make a drinking game out of this. All right. One shot, everybody. Let's go for at least two more by the end. But I do think that, you know, and this is something that, well, we've never spoken about it. I have learned from you, is nutrition research does vary country to country, lab to lab to lab, researcher to researcher to researcher. So then when someone comes along, decides to whack them all into a meta-analysis, it can almost end up being... A meta-analysis is a study of studies. For anyone who is unfamiliar, you don't have to be. Obviously, this is a little bit more science-heavy podcast today. It can almost then equate to this sort of like, well, if we look at what low-fat is in this country versus what a low-fat diet would qualify for in this country versus this, and then you whack them all into one and average it out, it's sort of like, well, how can you say anything is significant when it's all a little bit different? Or, you know, equally taking nutrients, and like the amount of stuff you would have to eat, like, oh, red wine's good for you, and it's
sure,
like, the amount resveratrol of red wine that you'd have to that you would have to drink would kill you first. You know, I find I'm always backpedaling. I'm always like, okay, but zoom out, go back one, like, control, like, get out of, you've walked yourself into this like very, very narrow view of what you need to be doing. But, you know, you're potentially worrying about one meal that you had one day that might have had, like, I don't know, bacon in it or something. What happens if you zoom out and look at the rest of your week? Then we can start to maybe rejig things and worry about things. But ultimately,
sure,
it's always, oh, this article said this about this nutrient. It's like, wow, when you actually look under the hood, wouldn't worry as much as you maybe think you need to.
Yeah. And this is the, there are, and I guess this is why I've always and still am, you know, my interest in nutrition is very much the kind of methodology stuff. I find it a very fascinating subject to try and use science for us to better understand, because it's complex. And because as far as other exposures in someone's life that influence their health, other than sleep, which someone will typically do every day, unless they're me and Ibiza. Otherwise, there would generally be some period of sleep in a 24-hour period. Nutrition diet is the exposure, to call it that, that people interact with every day of their life as a human necessity. And so it's not just that someone's eating once a day either. They're making multiple choices throughout the day to interact with an exposure that can enhance or detract from their health status. And it's typically not going to do that even in a short-term context. It's going to accumulate as a balance of good things versus bad things over time. And it's going to be a net effect of that cumulative exposure to, you've spent more of your time doing, you know, interacting with this thing that influences your health in a way that is a net positive over time versus a net negative. There's very few potentially positive behaviors that people will interact with every single day in that way. There are some negative behaviors, like people could, you know, drink every day, for example, or they could smoke every single day, and they would add up over time. But because they're slightly different, smoking has such a profoundly negative impact on someone's health that you don't even need randomized controlled trials. You don't need a tightly controlled intervention to tease out causation. It's so obvious just from observational research that smokers fucking die, and they get cancer and they die. And they die of loads of shit, but they die before people who don't smoke. So that's pretty easy to see.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad we've really nailed the educational portion. Smokers die. The end.
So they die. Yeah. And they die. And they die. And so with nutrition, we don't, you know, we're eating gram amounts of foods. I'm potentially doing that more or less frequently. So it's a lot more difficult to have precision to understand, oh, if someone eats processed meat every day, and we compare them to someone who doesn't, are they going to die first? And then it's like, okay, so long term, we can only really use observational research to try and tease out the effects of a total diet pattern or specific foods or even macronutrients as they relate to the risk of actually dying or having like, or ending up in hospital, like with a fucking coronary event or something. And then in the short term, the tighter the control that you want to apply to really learn, does this nutrient do this thing in the body? Does changing this ratio of macronutrients in the diet have this effect on, say, blood cholesterol or glucose tolerance? The more control you want to have on that question, the shorter the study is going to be. Like one of the studies that I did for my PhD was a lab study looking at basically kind of forced jet lag. It was 8 days. It's 8 days long. You can't keep people in a lab not seeing out a window for any longer than that. And then if we want to do an intervention trial that goes over the long term, like 1 year, a trial lasting a year in nutrition is like, wow, that's a big deal. Because you're asking people to change a behavior and sustain that. People can't even fucking get up in the morning at the same time. Like, people aren't good at changing behavior. But yet we view it as like, oh, this is a nutrition intervention. This is a diet trial. No, it's not. This is a behavior intervention, asking a group to adopt a new set of behaviors overnight and sustain those new set of behaviors for a year, and then expect that nothing else influenced the outcome other than that change in behavior, which may or may not have been sustained. So, and then as you said, with meta-analysis, then imagine taking a bunch of these studies and trying to combine them together in the hopes that what you're getting as your output is this average effect of this component of diet or not. But you can't average. It's like if you took an apple, a pear, an orange, and a kiwi fruit, what's the average fruit you get from that? Like, it's just not something that is averageable. It's not combinable. So this all, if you're a geek like me, makes nutrition as a research area, as a science, very interesting. How can we better acquire knowledge about what is really good or bad for health from this body of research? But it also means that there's a lot of, not even, I know we've been talking about a lot of bullshit, so to speak, and con artists and charlatans, even forgetting people with malintent, snake oil salesmen or saleswomen. The reality is, because of these complexities of nutrition, people that are quote unquote evidence-based fuck up their interpretation of nutrition studies all the time. And it's not their fault. It's a difficult science. Some of this shit is hard to spot. And yeah, I mean, I guess I should be thankful because it gives me a job. But yeah, that's what makes nutrition interesting, is actually trying to figure out, what do we really know and how do we actually know that? And yeah, like we said, we have a lot of the basics of what constitutes a healthy diet, but there's such enormous inter-individual variation, enormous. And that's probably where the future of understanding nutrition lies, you know? And maybe a lot of that's genetic. Like, why can I put person A on a diet to reduce their cholesterol and their cholesterol drops substantially versus putting person B on that diet and it doesn't really reduce their cholesterol levels? And that might just be a genetic answer, but there might be something dietary related to that. And maybe then, yeah, we might have more meaningful stuff to understand inter-individual variations, such that if we were dealing with someone who was from a South Asian background but lived in the UK, we might better understand, for example, what it is about diet and kind of diet gene ethnicity interactions that might make that person a higher cardiometabolic risk. That's the cool stuff that I think nutrition has still to answer. But yeah, as far as the broad stuff goes, even with all the limitations of the research that we've just described, we know what a healthy diet looks like.
Thank you for tuning in to part one of my episode with Dr. Alan Flanagan. Part two is coming next week because even I am tired of the sound of my own voice. But next week we chat appetite suppressant medication, personalized nutrition, is it a scam, drag queens, it with AI and like GLP-1s, appetite suppressant medication, are coaches obsolete? All of Alan's information is in the show notes, and you can go ahead and find him on Instagram at nutritional advocate. But you know, Alan and I touched on it at the end of part two next week. But ultimately, if you are an everyday average person, you're not aiming to get your nutrition master's degree. You're not a coach. You just kind of general have interest in nutrition, like just enough to be able to help yourself or ask questions to your coach or whatever, then don't follow Alan. I mean, you can if you want to, but like, don't worry about it. It's pretty advanced. And he'd be the first person to say that. So tune in to part two coming out next Monday, and I am so looking forward to hearing back your thoughts, feedbacks. Please leave us a review and shoot me a message on Instagram at Hunter Health Project. Let me know your thoughts, feelings, concerns, hopes, dreams, desires, anything really. I'd love to hear from you. So speak to you very soon. Bye.